Is it possible for a woman to rouse a king's conscience? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host for today's discussion. We're talking about background characters of the Old Testament, and our background character for today is Rizpah, concubine of King Saul. My conversation partners are again Dave Thomas and Paul Dibdall, and I'd like to turn to that question, is it possible for a woman to rouse a king's conscience? But to do that, I think we need to hear the story, since it's not a well-known story, and it has some things that we'll want to talk about. Paul, you have your Bible there. Why don't you read for us? It's in 2 Samuel 21. You read the first six verses, and then I'll read from verse 7 to the end of that section, verse 14. Now, let's keep in mind that this Rizpah that figures in this story is a concubine of Saul.
David's father, Saul, yes.
David's enemy, Saul.
Not father, yes. Not
David's
father.
Enemy. Now, the only other place she's mentioned is where Ish-bosheth accused Abner of having sexual relations with his concubine, and Abner really got angry. So she's just mentioned as an aside, and then she comes up in this story, a rather remarkable story. Let's hear it. Read the first six verses, and then I'll read 7 to 14.
Okay. During the reign of David, there was a famine for three successive years. So David sought the face of the Lord. The Lord said, "It is on account of Saul and his blood-stained house. It is because he put the Gibeonites to death." The king summoned the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not a part of Israel, but were survivors of the Amorites. The Israelites had sworn to spare them, but Saul, in his zeal for Israel and Judah, had tried to annihilate them. David asked the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? How shall I make amends so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance?" The Gibeonites answered him, "We have no right to demand silver or gold from Saul or his family, nor do we have the right to put anyone in Israel to death." "What do you want me to do for you?" David asked. They answered the king, "As for the man who destroyed us and plotted against us so that we have been decimated and have no place anywhere in Israel, let seven of his male descendants be given to us to be killed and exposed before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the Lord's chosen one." So the king said, "I will give them to you."
Picking up with verse 7. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Saul's son Jonathan, because of the oath of the Lord that was between them, between David and Jonathan, son of Saul. The king took the two sons of Rizpah, daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, Armonian Mephibosheth, and the five sons of Merab, daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. He gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they impaled them on the mountain before the Lord. The seven of them perished together. They were put to death in the first days of harvest, at the beginning of barley harvest. Then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it on a rock for herself from the beginning of harvest until rain fell on them from the heavens. She did not allow the birds of the air to come on the bodies by day or the wild animals by night. When David was told what Rizpah, daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the people of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the public square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hung them up on the day the Philistines killed Saul on Gibeah, on Gilboa. He brought them up from there, the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan, and they gathered the bones of those who had been impaled. They buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin in Selah, in the tomb of his father Kish. They did all that the king commanded. After that, God heeded supplications for the land.
Mm.
Now, I should note here that if that is a difficult story, you're not the first one to find it that way. For those of you who are familiar with the writings of Ellen White, there's an old index to the volume of Ellen White where she have all the biblical references where she comments on. And if you turn to 1 and 2 Samuel there, there are just many, many references to every single chapter until you get to this one. There's not a single comment. So Ellen White, in this case, is saying, if you don't know what to say, don't say it. But here we have Rizpah. Let's focus on Rizpah first, and then we'll...
So now we're going to try to say something.
We're going to try to say something, yeah.
Oh,
okay. What role here, what good things can you say about Rizpah under these circumstances? She's the background character, so we need to say something about Rizpah, and hopefully it's something good.
Well, I was struck by her loyalty to those who had died.
Huh?
She sat there, protected the remains persistently. I don't understand the story very well because it almost looks like human sacrifice has a role here. I mean, they impale them before God, and by this means the curse, as it were, is taken away. That's another whole story there. But
this, oh, by the way, is specified by the Gibeonites, not by David.
Yeah, so by the Gibeonites.
He says, "You have been wronged. What do you want me to do?" Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it's not David who is actually initiating
it.
But you're right. That is a problematic aspect of the story.
Yeah. But, I mean, here she is. She understands. I mean, it almost looks to me like she sees this as a religious obligation.
Yes.
To protect those things which have been offered as a sacrifice, as it were.
But it also triggers something in David, and that was my leading question. Can a woman rouse a king's conscience?
Sure.
Well, sure.
What was it that David had failed to do that Rizpah reminded him of?
He had failed to properly care for the bodies of Saul and Jonathan.
Yeah.
They had not received a proper burial, which was terribly important for the people at that time. So the way in which she honors those that have been slain reminds David of what he should have done with Saul and Jonathan, who were slain in battle.
Do we know how long it was from the death of Saul and Jonathan to this point?
I haven't figured out the chronology. I don't know whether one could do that. It just simply says there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, so it doesn't define that more narrowly.
Well, it would have been at least 3 years then since the death of, during the reign of David, three-year famine. So
3 year famine.
Some years have passed at least.
Yeah. But the event with the Gibeonite goes clear back to Joshua. And that's really an amazing one because the Gibeonites, if you know the story, God had commanded Israel, don't make any covenant with anybody anywhere. Okay. Well, the people found out what had happened to Jericho. The Gibeonites panicked, and they dressed up in old clothes, took moldy breads, and come limping into camp and says, "Oh, your reputation has come from afar, you know, and we would like to make a covenant with you." And it specifically says in the text in Joshua that Joshua did not ask the Lord, and he made a covenant with them. See? Well, when the people found out, they said, "We're going to wipe these people out." See? No, you don't wipe them out. In fact, what happened was when the rest of the people found out they'd made a covenant around there, they went to attack the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites said, "Hey, we'd like to call in our chips. Please help us," you see. And that's one of the things that's so terribly important in the Old Testament, and you see it reflected here. A promise is a promise is a promise. An oath is an oath is an oath.
Yeah.
Saul broke that oath, and so now the chickens come home to roost as far as David is concerned.
And amends, making amends is huge.
Oh, it is.
I mean, I've been thinking about that too, is it? If you can make amends, then the offense is gone. That seems to be a dynamic that's missing from life today.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there's a concept here which I think is very helpful for me in understanding the Old Testament. H. Wheeler Robinson is an Old Testament scholar who defined that in terms of corporate personality.
Mm.
The definition is the extension of a person's personality in time and place. So it extends beyond a person's death, and it involves his family or his nation. Aiken is a classic illustration of this. We tend to think in terms of individualist principles. You know, you sin. And in fact, there's an important law, Deuteronomy 24:16, which flies in the face of this. Deuteronomy 24:16 says, "Parents shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their parents. Only for their own crimes may persons be put to death." And I know that there are some very devout people who would like to focus on that law and ignore the narratives where that law simply is not. But some of these customs are deeply rooted And you have to deal with that.
Well, it's not just corporate personality, but the underlying sense of honor and shame that can fall on a group.
Yep.
And so this is an act which, in the minds of the Gibeonites, will remove that that disgrace and somehow place them back in a position of honor. And that's crucial in the story as well.
And it seems to be a very, might say, disciplined approach, mm-hmm. rather than just wiping everybody out.
They're almost gracious. They say, "Well, no, don't have to wipe everyone out. Just a representative sample from them, and that will be enough." Seven
will take care of it. See, so it's kind of like eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. It limits revenge rather than the natural impulse to just wipe everything out, like we discussed a few weeks ago, where David was going to wipe out all the males. No, this is not violence. This is very carefully
planned.
I
do like that mention of honor and shame, because I think that's a very big issue in some cultures even to this day.
If we look at this chapter and identify the things that would horrify us in terms of a sense of justice, there are many. We don't believe in corporate punishment at all. We don't believe in extended personality. In fact, it's kind of interesting when I ask my students, testing their feeling of corporate personality. If I said, "Now, we've got three people missing today, and if I were to say to you, now, unless we have everyone here tomorrow, you'll all lose a letter grade." And I said, "What would happen if I actually, you thought I was serious?" Almost always, somebody will pipe up and said, "We'd make sure everybody was here." But then the rest of the crowd comes in and says, "No, we'd beat a path to the door of Ginger Ketting Weller," and it really wouldn't happen that way. So this idea and the death penalty and the hangings and all of these things is so far removed. Is there any general way that we can explain that?
Way that we can explain what?
Explain just the differences. How in the world do you deal with things like that?
Well, to recognize the differences and try as best we can to enter into the culture and the worldview of those people, and then find those things in the story that we can, I think we can agree on something which is beautiful here in the story, which is Rizpah's act.
Yeah.
Of course, sometimes this corporate personality works in favor, like the Philippian jailer was baptized and all his family.
It's wonderful. Yeah. See, and I think we can learn from that. I kind of like that tribal sense. See?
Yeah.
I think of a phrase from Roland Blyke, and I like clues this one. He says, "God always expects us to be faithful to our conscience. And if you are in a culture where some of these things are deeply embedded, God expects, first of all, for you to be faithful to your conscience. In this case, keeping your oath and proper burial rites. And these are the things that David had to put right. Only then would God heal supplications from the land." Next time, we turn to an even more difficult story, The Man of God, where obedience is not optional. It's a very strange story. Thank you, David and Paul, for your help. And my thanks also to Chad Ofterhauer, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.